Over breakfast, she asked Xi if he was disappointed. Disappointed? To go there? He lifted his eyes skyward. To see them and to be disappointed. This is no disappointment. We have lost a minor skirmish. He would shortly be departing for China, where he had agreed to make no public statements about what had happened in the machine. But he would return to supervise the dig at Xi'an. The tomb of Xin was waiting for him. In Davy, Ellie sensed a grief she had never before noticed. She assumed it was a reaction to the skepticism with which Project Directorate and the governments had greeted their story, but Devi shook her head. Whether they believe us is not very important for me. The experience itself is central. Yes, I'm sad. You know, I satisfied a lifelong wish up there when I found Surinder again, after all these years. He was exactly as I remembered him, exactly as I've dreamed of him. But when I saw him, I knew. This love was precious, because it had been snatched away, because I had given up so much to marry him. Nothing more. The man was a fool. 10 years with him and we would have been divorced. Maybe only 5, but I was so young and so foolish. For the first time in my adult life, I do not mourn Surinder. What I mourn is the family I renounced for his sake. I will not permit anyone to trivialize this experience. Ellie, remember, it really happened. It was not a dream. She was returning to Bombay for a few days, and then would visit her ancestral village. Ada was, considering the circumstances, very relaxed. While Ellie and Vege had been undergoing lengthy interrogations, he had been calculating.
I think the tunnels are Einstein-Rosen bridges. General relativity admits a class of solutions called wormholes, similar to black holes, but with no evolutionary connection. They cannot be generated, as black holes can, by the gravitational collapse of a star. But the usual sort of wormhole once made expands and contracts before anything can cross through. It exerts disastrous tidal forces, and it also requires, at least as seen by an observer left behind, an infinite amount of time to get through. He said that the key problem was holding the wormhole open. He had found a class of solutions to his field equations that suggested a new macroscopic field, a kind of tension that could be used to prevent a wormhole from contracting fully. Such a wormhole would pose none of the other problems of black holes. It would have much smaller tidal stresses, two-way access, quick transit times as measured by an exterior observer, and no devastating interior radiation field. He was eager to return to Lagos to try to work through the new physics their experience had implied, and most of all, to see his wife and children.
Ellie, will you do something for me? Remember everything that happened, every detail. Write it down. Our experience represents experimental data. One of us may have seen some point that the others missed. Something essential for a deep understanding of what happened. Send me what you write. I have asked the others to do the same.
They were departing for their separate nations, and it felt to Ellie as if her own family were being sundered, broken, dispersed. She too had found the experience transforming. A demon had been exorcised, several. And just when she felt more capable of love than she had ever been, she found herself alone. A bargain was made. She could go back to Argus, although no longer as director, and pursue any scientific problem she pleased. She had, if she liked, lifetime tenure. Kitz had said,
"We're not unreasonable. You come back with a solid piece of evidence, something really convincing, and we'll join you in making the announcement. We'll say we asked you to keep the story quiet until we could be absolutely sure. Within reason, we'll support any research you want to do."
Perhaps the president had helped him change his mind. It was unlikely Kitz was enjoying the compromise. But in return, however, Ellie must say nothing about what had happened aboard the machine. If she breathed a word, the spurious psychiatric profile would find its way to the media, and reluctantly, she would be dismissed. She wondered whether they had tried to buy the others' silence. She couldn't see how, short of shooting the debriefing teams, they could hope to keep this quiet forever. So, she concluded, they were buying time. It surprised her how mild the threatened punishments were.
Ellie thought Kitz would attempt something more. What he agonized about, she was sure, was the possibility that the tunnel was still open. She thought the Hokkaido facility would soon be disassembled. Then, after a decent interval when the world's attention was distracted by other matters, perhaps there would be an explosion at the machine site. Kitz might think that should shake the nozzle loose, but Ellie doubted if any explosion, nuclear or conventional, could disengage the Earth from the tunnel. The next day, President Lasker awarded her the National Medal of Freedom in a public ceremony at the White House. Logs were burning in a fireplace set in a white marble wall. The president had committed a great deal of political as well as financial capital to the machine project and was determined to make the best face of it before the nation and the world. Investments in the machine by the United States and other nations, the argument went, had paid off handsomely. New technologies, new industries were blossoming, promising at least as much benefit for ordinary people as the inventions of Thomas Edison. We had discovered that we are not alone, that intelligences more advanced than we existed out there in space. They had changed forever, the president said, our conception of who we are. Speaking for herself, but also, she thought, for most Americans, the discovery had strengthened her belief in God, now revealed to be creating life and intelligence on many worlds, a conclusion she was sure would be in harmony with all religions. But the greatest good granted us by the machine was the spirit it had brought to Earth, the increasing mutual understanding within the human community, the sense that we were all fellow passengers on a perilous journey in space and in time, the goal of a global unity of purpose that was now known all over the planet as Machindo. Dr. Arroway had willingly risked her life. It was not Dr. Arroway's fault that nothing happened when the machine was activated. She deserved the thanks of all Americans and of all people everywhere on Earth. Ellie was a very private person. She should now be permitted some real privacy so she could resume her scientific career. The president hoped the press would respect Dr. Arroway's wish. Ellie left Washington without determining how much the president knew. She was glad to be back in New Mexico, glad to be setting up a new, although much smaller-scale, research program. Because so much telescope time had been freed when the signal from Vega had ceased, there was a heady air of progress in a dozen long-languishing subdisciplines of radio astronomy. At first, a sizable press corps haunted the area in hopes of shouting a question at her or photographing her through a telescopic lens, but she remained resolutely isolated. Over the following weeks and months, the battalion of reporters dwindled to a company and then to a platoon. Now only a squad of the most steadfast remained, mostly from the World Hologram and other sensationalist weekly newspapers. A television special on her life, made without her consent, described Ellie as more reclusive now than Neil Armstrong or even Greta Garbo. Ellie took it all with cheerful equanimity. She was otherwise occupied. Indeed, she was working night and day. Through open-channel asynchronous telenetting, she and Vega organized a long-term research program. Among the objects to be examined were the vicinity of Sagittarius A, at the center of the galaxy, and the great extragalactic radio source, Cygnus A. The Argus telescopes were employed as part of a phased array linked with the Russian telescopes. Together, they acted as if they were part of a single radio telescope the size of the Earth. Operating at a wavelength of a few centimeters, they could resolve sources of radio emission as small as the inner solar system if they were as far away as the center of the galaxy. She spent most of her time writing, modifying existing programs for the Cray-21, and setting down an account, as detailed as she possibly could make it, of the events that had been squeezed into the 20 minutes of Earth time after they activated the machine. Halfway through, she realized she was writing Samizdat, typewriter and carbon paper technology. She locked the original and two copies in her safe and secreted the third copy behind a loose plank in the electronics bay of Telescope 49. She burned the carbon paper. In 6 months, about the time she finished reprogramming, Palmer Joss presented himself at the Argus front gate. Even here in the Southwest, he wore, as always,
a jacket, a white shirt, and a tie. She gave him the palm frond, thanked him for the pendant, and despite all of Kitz's admonitions, told him everything. They adopted the old practice of her Soviet colleagues, who, whenever anything politically unorthodox needed to be said, discovered the urgent necessity for a brisk walk. He listened sympathetically, intelligently, indeed generously, especially for someone whose doctrines must be challenged at their fundaments by her account. After all his reluctance at the time the message had first been received, at last she was showing Argus to him. He was companionable, and she found herself happy to see him. Apparently at random, they climbed up the narrow metal exterior stairways that straddled the base of Telescope 49. The vista of 130 radio telescopes, most of them on their own sets of railway tracks, was like nothing else on Earth. In the electronics bay, she slid back the plank and retrieved a bulky envelope with Joss's name on it. He put it in his inside breast pocket. She told him about her computer program. It's very time-consuming, even with the Cray, to calculate pi out to something like 10 to the 20th place. And we don't know that what we're looking for is in pi. They sort of said it wasn't. It might be E. It might be one of the family of transcendental numbers they told Vege about. It might be some altogether different number. So a simple-minded brute force approach, just calculating fashionable transcendental numbers forever, is a waste of time. But here at Argus, we have very sophisticated decryption algorithms designed to find patterns in a signal, designed to pull out and display anything that looks non-random. So I rewrote the programs. From the expression on his face, she was afraid she had not been very clear. She made a small swerve in the monologue. But not to calculate the digits in a number like pi, print them out and present them for inspection. There isn't enough time for that. Instead, the program races through the digits in pi and pauses to think about it only when there's some anomalous sequence of zeros and ones, something non-random. 10% of the digits will be zeros and another 10% will be ones, on average. The program knows what's expected statistically and only pays attention to unexpectedly long sequences of zeros and ones. And it doesn't only look in base 10. I don't understand. If you look at enough random numbers, won't you get any pattern you want simply by chance? Sure, but you can calculate how likely that is. It's like the search for the message. In both cases, we're looking for a signal that's well out of the noise, something that can't be just a statistical fluke. If after a while we get a long sequence of just zeros and ones, well, maybe we could pull a picture out, if there's one in there. It could be anything. You could decode a picture hiding in pi, and it would be a mess of Hebrew letters? Sure. He looked at her quizzically. Forgive me, Eleanor, but don't you think you're being a mite too indirect? Why don't you just tell your story? Palmer, if I had hard evidence, I'd speak up. But if I don't have any, people like Kitz will say that I'm lying or hallucinating. That's why the manuscript's in your pocket. You're going to seal it, date it, notarize it, and put it in a safety deposit box. If anything happens to me, you can release it to the world. I give you full authority to do anything you want with it. And if nothing happens to you? Then, when we find what we're looking for, that manuscript will confirm our story. If we find evidence of a double black hole at the galactic center, or some huge artificial construction in Cygnus A, or a message hiding inside pi, this... She tapped him on the chest. This will be my evidence. Then I'll speak out. In the meantime, don't lose it. Ellie, I still don't fully understand. We know there's a mathematical order to the universe, the law of gravity and all that. How is this different? So there's order inside the digits of pi? So what? No. Don't you see, this would be different. This isn't just starting the universe out with some precise mathematical laws that determine physics and chemistry. This is a message. Whoever makes the universe hides messages in transcendental numbers so they'll be read 15 billion years later when intelligent life finally evolves. You think God is a mathematician? Something like that. If what we're told is true, if this isn't a wild goose chase, If there's a message hiding in Pi, well, that's a lot of ifs.
If you're looking for revelation in arithmetic, I know a better way.
Palmer, this is the only way. This is the only thing that would convince a skeptic. Imagine we find something. It doesn't have to be tremendously complicated, just something more orderly than could accumulate by chance. That's all we need. Then mathematicians all over the world can find exactly the same pattern or message or whatever it proves to be. Look, no one could then argue that the key miracle in the religion is some conjurer's trick, or that later historians have falsified the record, or that it's just hysteria or a delusion or a substitute parent for when we grow up. Everyone could be a believer. You can't be sure you'll find anything. You can hide here and compute till the cows come home, or you can go out and tell your story to the world. Sooner or later, you'll have to choose. Why are you so eager for me to tell my story, Palmer? Don't you think there's been a strange reversal of our positions? Here I am, the bearer of the profound religious experience I can't prove, really. Palmer, I can barely fathom it. And here you are, a hardened skeptic, trying, more successfully than I ever did, to be kind to the credulous.
Oh, no, Eleanor. I'm not a skeptic. I'm a believer.
Are you? The story I have to tell isn't exactly about punishment and reward. It's not exactly Advent and Rapture. There's not a word in it about Jesus. A part of my message is that we're not central to the purpose of the cosmos. What happened to me makes us all seem very small.
It does.
But it also makes God very big. I've been searching, Eleanor. After all these years, believe me, I know the truth when I see it. Any faith that admires truth, that strives to know God, must be brave enough to accommodate the universe. I mean the real universe. All those light years. All those worlds. I think of the scope of your universe, the opportunities it affords the Creator, and it takes my breath away. It's much better than bottling him up in one small world. Your universe has room enough and time enough for the kind of God I believe in. People are going to believe you, Eleanor. Millions of them, all over the world. I know it for certain.
She shook her head, and they walked on in silence before he continued. All right, then, I understand. You take as much time as you have to.
I understand, too, Palmer. Bear with me a few more months. If we haven't found something in Pi by then, I'll consider going public with what happened up there. And maybe Ada and the others would be willing to speak out also. Okay?
They walked back toward the Argus administration building.
Have you ever been married, Ellie?
No, I guess I've been too busy.
Ever been in love?
Halfway, half a dozen times, but there was always so much noise. The signal was hard to find. And you?
Never. But I have faith.
He smiled.
The nursing home called. Ellie's mother was failing. She rushed to Wisconsin, but was too late. Her mother had died. She called Joss and asked him if he would perform the funeral service.
I don't have to tell you I'm not formally religious, but there were times when my mother was.
He would be there on the next plane, he assured her. In her hotel room that evening, a chime sounded, and the not-quite-noiseless carriage of her telefax came to life. It was linked to the Argus computer. There was no real urgency. Whatever the computer had found was not about to go away. Pi would not set as the Earth turned. If there was a message hiding inside Pi, it would wait for her forever.
Stand by, the computer printed out on the telefax screen.
The Argus computer had gone deep into Pi, deeper than anyone on Earth had ever gone, but not nearly so deep as the caretakers had ventured. This was much too soon, she thought, to be the long, undecrypted message about which her father had told her on the shores of that uncharted sea. Maybe this was just a gearing up, a preview of coming attractions, an encouragement to further exploration, so humans would not lose heart. Whatever it was, it could not possibly be the message the caretakers were struggling with.
Transmission problem. Please stand by.
She was linked to the Argus computer by a communications relay satellite. Perhaps there had been an attitude control problem or a programming foul-up. In the meantime, she had to make the arrangements for her mother's funeral. She turned away from the computer screen. She had to make lists and telephone calls. Ellie had programmed the computer to be persistent, even a little innovative, in attracting her attention if it thought it had found something in Pi. The anomaly showed up most starkly in base 11 arithmetic, where it could be written out entirely as zeros and ones. Compared with what had been received from Vega, this could be at best a simple message, but its statistical significance was high. The program reassembled the digits into a square raster, an equal number across and down. The first line was an uninterrupted file of zeros left to right. The second line showed a single numeral 1, exactly in the middle, with zeros to the borders left and right. After a few more lines, an unmistakable arc had formed, composed of ones. The simple geometrical figure had been quickly constructed line by line. The last line of the figure emerged, all zeros except for a single-centered 1. The subsequent line would be zeros only, part of the frame. Hiding in the alternating patterns of digits deep inside the transcendental number was a perfect circle, its form traced out by unities in a field of knots. The universe was made on purpose, the circle said. In whatever galaxy you happen to find yourself, you take the circumference of a circle, divide it by its diameter, measure closely enough, and uncover a miracle. Another circle, drawn kilometers downstream of the decimal point. There would be richer messages further in. It doesn't matter what you look like, or what you're made of, or where you come from. As long as you live in this universe and have a modest talent for mathematics, sooner or later, you'll find it. It's already here. It's inside everything. You don't have to leave your planet to find it. In the fabric of space and in the nature of matter, as in a great work of art, there is, written small, the artist's signature. Standing over humans, gods and demons, subsuming caretakers and tunnel builders, there is an intelligence that antedates the universe. The circle had closed. She had found what she had been searching for.
Contact was written by Carl Sagan and read by Jody Foster. It was abridged for audio by Ann Davis. Editing, post-production, and sound design by Michael Jones. The associate producer was Sloan Seaman. Contact was produced and directed by Karen Frillman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Contact is available in paperback from Pocket Books.